ladies and gentlemen, you're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. Make sure you got pen and paper. Make sure you're ready to listen closely. I'm going to go right into it right now. I want to thank all those of you who have sent your donations for the month of March. Those of you who have not, please get them in the mail right now. HOTT, H-O-T-T, in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's HOTT, H-O-T-T, in care of 101.1 FM, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925.
We thought we would reach out and ask Walker for the first time. So we could reach out and ask Walker if he would mind, being our luncheon speaker today. And we're just very happy to be able to introduce Walker. Thank
you. For buying the tech out of this, gentlemen here, and the video audio group has been okay here. I am as surprised as a lot of people to be here today, because I didn't know this was happening until about 10 days ago when Doctors called me about this. I do have to offer some disclaimers before I begin. As Bob noted, I'm a practicing attorney, and so to stay in good standing with the bar, I have to state my position on taxes. They're an unfortunate aspect of government, and my advice to everybody is pay first and complain later. To be taken as a serious policy player in this town, meaning Washington, alas, whether you agree with that position or not, that's what you have to do. You got to pay first and complain later. The idea of don't pay and complain just becomes all too easy for the political system, the courts, and others to dismiss you as a group of ballot intents. To the extent it's feasible, therefore, pay first and complain loud, complain later, early and often. That having been said, move on to the main substance of the talk. I've never written a paper, I guess, really on this issue, what we might call the dark doings of 1913, as it were. But you can come very close to it, being between the lines, and making the gist of my remarks. In a working paper that I wrote in 1994 at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, and that learned later has been posted widely on the internet, called Working Paper 9405, Working Paper 9405 at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. It's been later published in a few places. One version is by the Committee for Monetary Research and Education in Charlotte, North Carolina. You can email to cmre at worldnet.att.net and ask for the paper under the title Constitutional Republic, the Corporate State, the Federal Reserve Board, 1931-34. It was also later revised and published as an academic paper in a series, those who have access to economics libraries. You can find it in Research and Financial Services, an annual volume, I think it's number 10, either 8 or 10, I forget which. But anyway, the title there was the Federal Reserve Board and the Banking Crisis of the 1930s. The editor of that series is George Kaufman. Okay, so that's sort of where you can find written text to support some, if not most, of what I'll say here today. I propose to Bob that the general topic be approached as follows. First, you kind of have to understand what money is, or has traditionally been thought to be, what a central bank is, and what its relationship is to, quote, money, end quote, and then finally, what is the Federal Reserve, where it came from, what the intentions of the framers of the Federal Reserve were, and how they've evolved over the years. You kind of have to add them all up together. I think it's wrong to seize upon, as I put it to Bob, one leg of the elephant and proclaim that you've got it all. You do have to understand, alas, a lot more to understand this topic than you might think you'll get just by sitting down and reading one of the pamphlets. First, this question, what is money? J.P. Morgan, the old banker, was asked that question during the National Monetary Committee hearings that preceded the Federal Reserve Act in about 1912. Morgan thought for a moment and said, Mr. Chairman, you asked me what is money. Gold is money. Everything else is credit. Okay. In the old days, there was... How old, by the way? Anyone want to guess how far back you can go in recorded human history and find explicit references to money? We're probably about 2,500, maybe 3,000 BC in the Babylonian Sumerian writings, right? But it turns out that if you deal with ancient texts, as I used to when I was a French scholar, probably two-thirds of all the old documents that survive are either some recordings of commercial transactions, deed recordings, and the like, if something to do with money. I'll give you the reference that is the oldest one I know of that you can conveniently find. I brought the Gideon Bible down from my room. Turn to Genesis chapter 23. And it says there that after Sarah died, Abraham sought to buy a resting place for Sarah. He wound up buying a cave in a field that Hebron, modern Hebron, calls Mount Sheba. And he decided he had to buy it from the local Hittite tribe, who owned the territory at that time. They offered to give him the tomb, but he said, no, if I want to establish unchallengeable property rights for myself and my descendants, I have to pay for it openly and unquestioningly and at full market value. If you give it to me, someone later on may come and say, we're taking back the gift. So I want to buy it. And the king then named an outrageous price. He said, okay, I'll charge you 400 shekels of silver. In those days, that was considered an enormous sum. It would be like what, suppose you had a piece of land the size of this ballroom, 150 miles out in Virginia, and you said, how much do I do you take from the land here? And you said, oh, $40,000 ought to do the trick. Well, it's a pretty small piece of land, $40,000, but that's the equivalent in terms of the money of those days, what they were asking Abraham to pay. He swallowed hard and said, okay, I'll pay it. And on the appointed hour, they assembled all the nobles of the Hittites into a large assembly hall, and with everybody watching, Abraham steps up to the balance scale and weighs out the silver on the scale, paying off the 400 shekels of value. Why did he do that? So nobody could challenge his property right because everybody had seen him pay for it. Went through something like that and do it in front of hundreds of witnesses. Here's the key phrase. Verse 16, Genesis 23. He paid him the sum named in the audience, the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with the merchant. There it is, money. Not just money, but current money. And the merchants are invoked. Well, what was that stuff, current money with the merchant? Now, this may be Elizabethan England at the time when the King James Version of the Bible was translated. Most literate people would have known what that phrase meant. That's why they use that phrase often in the translations. But current money with the merchant was graded on the elements. First, what is money? Well, in the ancient world, was money something that the king or the local nobles handed out on the street corners in an initial distribution or paid out as payroll checks? And then the people used it for their current transactions? Or rather, did the people have money or something they were using as money first, and then the government tried to get it from them by way of taxes? Anyway, this is the ancient debate, and it's still today. Is money something that the people trust customarily and by tradition has, and then the government tries to get it from them. Only for good purposes, to be sure. The rival theory, and one that is still wildly popular among modern academic economists and even been enshrined to some extent in the modern uniform commercial code, is what we might call the legal tender theory of money. That is, money is whatever the local government says it is. You mean, forward, by the way, when is that passage in Genesis that is describing the events around Abraham occurring? Oh, about 2000 BC, maybe? Skip forward a few hundred years, several hundred years, to the time of Aristotle, the 4th century Athens BC. Aristotle wrote in a book called the Nicomachean Ethics and a chapter on justice, a short dissertation on money, the origins of money. He says money essentially arises out of the barter system. A cobbler might exchange shoes for a carpenter to build his house, for example, and then they have to reckon the number of shoes you have to pay to get a house. Over time, accounting systems arise in which you reckon that it would be easier to use some standard neutral measure, unit of account, as the measuring rod. So in the old world, they used cows, they used grain. So many bushels of grain equals so much in value of silver, and so on. And dealing with money from the customary and traditional perspective, that's how it came about, through evolution away from barter. If you want to read the modern economic description of the rise of barter exchange and its transformation into a modern money system, read Alfred Marshall, the turn of the century English economist. His book, Money, Credit, and Commerce, makes the same story appears in his Principles of Economics, which was published in the 1920s in their last editions. Why is Marshall important? He was sort of the last, the old line of classical economists. And he was also John Maynard Keynes' teacher, so indirectly he has some influence on the modern world. Pause briefly just before Aristotle. Sometime, possibly as far back as, say, 1000, 1300 BC, some of the Grecian civilizations, city-states, began to use coins, silver coins, stamped by the king, local king, for the impressions of alignment. These began to circulate among the people and be used as money. From that story begins the rise of what we now think of as modern government created or government-oriented money. At the time of the founding of the American Republic, what kind of money was there in America? Was there a federal government money? Well, not until the Revolution, of course. The Continental Congress first began meeting, I believe, in 1774, and they had to use whatever was sent to them by the state as money to pay the bills. The colonies didn't really have a means of creating silver coin, gold coin of themselves. They didn't have much to speak of. Adam Smith writes in the last chapter of The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, that one of the mistakes made by the British government and British merchants is to try to extract gold and silver from the colonies when in fact they have none. And so we used borrowed money. We used Spanish coins that happened to circulate here. Dutch coins. Whatever came our way would be used as the only hard money circulated. During the Revolution, the Continental Congress authorized the circulation of paper money, continental currency, which depreciated rapidly around 1779, 1780, and was ready to not worth the continental. Derived from that unhappy inflationary experience. Well, all of this was fresh in the minds of the founding fathers as we sat around that summer in Philadelphia in 1787. And they began to debate the question, what kind of money shall the new republic have? And by the way, as Bob was properly pointing out in his introduction,
Where in the Constitution is the money power clause? Is it an executive branch power, or is it a congressional power?
Congressional, right? Congress shall have the power to regulate the value of coin money and regulate the value of foreign coin, right? Doesn't say the president. Doesn't say the treasury secretary. So that was the decision on that narrow question. Then a lot of people have the impression that the Constitution also says, and by the way, nothing but gold and silver shall ever be legal tender in the United States. Does it say that? No. It says no state shall make anything except gold and silver a legal tender. They wanted to kill off the state issued paper money that enslaved them in the colonial revolutionary time. Okay? What about the U.S. government, federal government, and paper money? This issue was debated on the floor of the Constitutional Convention. And the gist of the debate was as follows. Even in the surprising result, even for those who we normally think of as apostles of modern liberty, like George Mason said, the debate came down roughly to this, with people that we might loosely associate today with an investment banking crowd, if it was New York, or once we New York, the local real estate promotion and development crowd, kind of folks who always want to see asset values rising in nominal terms, even if they're not rising in real terms. They said we should not prohibit the issuance of paper money. It's a useful measure in times of distress for the government. Alexander Hamilton was probably the leading spokesman for the convention for that point of view. Worth noting that he later became the first Treasury Secretary. The rival point of view, the Jeffersonian faction's point of view, was essentially, we shouldn't hate paper money. We think it belongs to the slaves of Egypt, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse, among the great evils of the world. But if there were a war or other national emergency of similar magnitude, we do not want to explicitly tie the hands of Congress. And so the issue remains silent in the Constitution. Okay? A fair translation of that from the perspective of a constitutional scholar would be, the Jeffersonians decided that they didn't have the votes to cram down an absolute prohibition of paper money. They would leave it silent and trust in the good faith of the executive and the judiciary going forward to prevent the usage of paper money outside wartime, outside the time of national emergency. So, in fact, as time went on, one brief pause, in 1790, December, Alexander Hamilton did draft the Secretary of the Treasury a proposal for the creation of a sort of central bank. He called it a national bank, the first bank of the United States, and sent the bill over to Congress for its approval. Hamilton's followers had won the first congressional election in 1788. He controlled the House by about a 2-1 margin, and the states voted by state, of course, in those days. Essentially, the state legislatures appointed senators, and he had a slight majority in the Senate, maybe 7-6 or 8-5. So, whatever he wanted, he could get in the financial realm. So, the National Bank bill sails on through Congress and lands in George Washington's desk, and he doesn't quite know what to do with it. Does anyone recall, by the way, what the name was of the presiding officer at the Constitutional Convention? Who was the chairman during that summer? George Washington. Well, he was there. He heard this debate on paper money and national banking that we've been talking about. Another important constitutional provision to the convention. What did it say in the Constitution that Congress shall have the power to charter a national bank or a central bank? It's not there. Was it brought up? Yes, it was. And from an interesting source, James Madison, following on a proposed amendment by Benjamin Franklin one day, I think in August, James Madison suggested that
One of the clauses in Article 1, Section 8 be amended to allow the federal government to charter corporations for useful purposes. And he had in mind building roads, cutting canals, and so on, and maybe to create a national university one day. Others stood up and objected that, Mr. Madison, you do not understand the mindset, the way people think in affairs of finance and money. They will take that corporation charter clause that you just mentioned, and they will interpret it as the authority to create a central bank or a national bank. And we don't want that. Madison agreed. The Hamiltonian faction conferred among themselves and decided that it would be better to withdraw the proposition than to have a recorded vote against it, lest at some future date somebody like me would stand up and say, well, they brought it up and they voted no on it, so how can you say it's in the Constitution? It was withdrawn, and that was the end of it. So anyway, Hamilton, as I said, introduced his National Bank bill, Bill Ryan at Washington's desk. Washington was there. He knew about this debate that I just described to you. But he turns to the Secretary of State, Jefferson, the best lawyer in the cabinet, and says, you write me an opinion on this thing. I don't know quite what to do with it. And Jefferson writes back a very nice, brief outline style opinion saying that the federal government has no power to charter corporations, especially not a central bank. It was brought up in vote and withdrawn rather than be voted down. It's hard to find this within the powers explicit in the Constitution. And I remind you, Mr. President, that if we approve this thing, we will have crossed beyond strict construction of the Constitution. To take a single step beyond the powers narrowly confined for Congress is to open a boundless field of power. It's sort of like once you decided to step outside the bounds of strict legality, say, what rules bind you then? So, anyway, at the end, though, Jefferson gave Washington his way out. He said, if, however, you think it's a close call in your mind, then I would urge you to go ahead and support the bill, sign the bill. Because at the time, E. Jefferson thought the veto power should not be used or abused by the executive on anything that was close to the constitutional limits of congressional power. The executive should go along with what Congress wanted. In a nutshell, is what it said at the end. Hamilton then was asked to write an opinion against Jefferson's, and he wrote a long opinion on the National Bank that is a classic of reasoning of those who follow his school of thought about money and banking. These two opinions, by the way, by Jefferson and Hamilton, were not published at the time. Remember, they were given to George Washington for his private usage and guidance in deciding whether to sign the National Bank Bill. They remained in Washington's personal papers. A cousin of Washington named John Marshall was given Washington's personal papers at his death with a wish that he write a biography of Washington. And so the first official biography of Washington was published in 1807 after Marshall had already become Chief Justice. And in an appendix in one of the volumes, E. Marshall summarizes this debate I just described. Later in 1819, in a court case called McCulloch versus Maryland, Supreme Court opinion, the single most important Supreme Court opinion ever, in my opinion. It's taught badly in law schools. It's taught for a phrase that Daniel Webster, general counsel of the bank, used in the Supreme Court argument. He said, runners, the power to tax, the power to destroy. The state of Maryland can tax the Bank of the United States branches in Maryland. Then the states may essentially swap whatever the federal government wishes to use in a state by just taxing it. So we can't have that, can we? Marshall said no. Right, Mr. Webster, power of tax, power to destroy. Remember, the federal government is taxing. The states have no right to tax the establishment of the federal government, period, end of argument. But the longer part of McCulloch is about the Hamilton versus Jefferson debate. The first part of McCulloch is about, is the national bank constitutional? And Marshall said, or we honor the opinion, that we can consider issues like this long after they just arose. The National Bank Bill was signed by Washington in 1791. Here it is 1819. It's 28 years later. Why are we first considering the constitutionality of the national banks today? But I'm willing to do it, Marshall said. Clear usurpation of constitutional authority may be challenged even after a delay longer than this. By running back and past Justice Department these days, anyway, Marshall, having in his possession those two opinions of Jefferson and Hamilton, summarized Jefferson's arguments and then went on to quote extensively, verbatim, from Hamilton's opinion, without citing it as a source, of course. And it wasn't until about 10 years later, around 1828, that these opinions were finally published. And Andrew Jackson vetoed a bill that would recharter the Second Bank of the United States in about 1832. He vetoed it on the ground that whatever John Marshall said, he, Jackson, thought the bank was unconstitutional. It was outside the powers of Congress to create such a bank. Okay. If you've never read his veto message on the Second Bank, it's a nice little opinion. Defenders of the Hamiltonian point of view always point to it as ranting and raving by populist demagogues. It was drafted by Roger Taney, Attorney General at the time, who later was appointed to the Supreme Court. The Second Bank, though, died. Its charter was expired in 1836. A few years later, debating what to do with the Treasury's money, funds paid into the Treasury's taxes, it was decided to create a sub-treasury or an independent treasury system. The Treasury used to have branches in the major cities of the United States, more or less where there are branches of the Federal Reserve today. And so, if you were someone who had to pay customs duties or other taxes to the Treasury, you just march into your nearest sub-Treasury branch and make the payment. How many of you have been to Federal Hall in New York City on Wall Street abroad? The site in New York where George Washington was first sworn in as President of the United States, his statue is out there. Well, the modern Federal Hall, modern building is over 100 years old. But the building was erected as one of those sub-treasury branches. So if you've ever been in Federal Hall, you've been in a sub-treasury. There was no central bank of the United States between 1836 and 1913. So how did we survive in those days? Well, somebody said really well. And that issue was debated. My personal opinion is we didn't do badly, especially after the national bank system was created during the Civil War. As a means of financing the North during the Civil War, Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase proposed that President Lincoln proposed, and Congress approved, and they did, a system in which nationally chartered banks, not dependent on the states for their powers, would be created. And these banks would be allowed to circulate their own notes to be used as currency, as long as those notes were backed in turn by a full deposit of at least an equal amount of U.S. bonds at the Treasury or sub-Treasury branches. same. Now, once gold was resumed, about 13 years after the Civil War, that meant that those bonds had to be payable in gold. So, from about 1879 onward, under the old national bank system, a national bank could circulate its own currency as long as they were fully backed by a deposit of gold-paying bonds at the U.S. Treasury Department. And method credit was more limited then than it is today. There was no equivalent of credit cards. Every time they can carry it, you must get credit. But what credit there was cheaper than it is today. You could commonly borrow 2, 3, 4, maybe 5%. And that's the problem of doing away with modern central bank money issuing systems and trying to go back to either the three central bank national bank system, fully backed by deposits and gold, or to a purely private money system. If you did that, you have to decide how easy is credit going to be to come by. Credit is hard to get in those systems. Now, remember the investment bankers and real estate promoters I referred to earlier? How do you think they feel when you say, boy, interest rates are going to fall down to 2 or 3%, but it's going to be real hard to get credits? How do investment bankers and promoters feel about this thing? They don't like it, because it tends to depress nominal asset values. So whenever these proposed propositions come up, guess who the main opposition always is? By the time we get to 1913, in a nutshell, what had happened was that there had been a few banking panics. If you read the writings of those who argued for the creation of the Federal Reserve and the modern central banking system in 1913, they would argue that from 1879 onward, it was a story of unremitting panic, never-ending depression. There was never enough money available, never enough credit available. 1907, there was a financial panic in New York, arising from the usual reason. The major banks had raised too many loans to borrowers who were essentially frauds and promoters, particularly the Knickerbocker Trust Company in New York. And enough of the banks got involved in loans to the Knickerbocker that J.P. Morgan had to organize a rescue effort to save the New York clearinghouse itself. They went to Congress after the panic was over and proposed that the banks of New York or any other city where there was a clearinghouse association be allowed to issue emergency currency for up to 6 months, backed not by these deposits of gold-paying bonds of the Treasury, but instead private citizens' obligations as long as they were nominally payable in gold. It was a means of transforming private monetary instruments into officially authorized currency. Okay. The next several years, there were academic studies, some funded by the commercial banking interests in New York, some funded by farmer and other agricultural interests in the West. And there was a hot debate on monetary reform. This National Monetary Commission held hearings, wrote treatises, and so on. Finally, in 1912-1913, the issue comes to a head. There were four original main streams of thought that fed into the Federal Reserve Act. So remember my analogy of the elephant and its four legs, and as you lower the trunk and the tails for the moment? You're wrong. Grab one leg and say, this is it, this is gospel, this is the truth, and nothing else matters. You're wrong. There are four competing streams. And it's sort of like that debate on the Constitutional Convention floor that I was describing. How would you parse that? How would you translate it today? Is the issuance of paper money by the central government authorized? Well, I'm a fan of investment bankers and real estate developers. I might stand up and say, at least it's not explicitly prohibited. Right? And so it is the way the Federal Reserve Act is put together. Was there a faction, as you will often hear, that was representing, say, the foreign banking interests, the European bankers, the J.P. Morgan Trust, the August Belmont Trust. And they hire these scholars, and they hide them away on Jekyll Island, Georgia, and they come up with a grant, the Federal Reserve Bill. And they run to Washington, they cram it down the throats of all the congressmen, spread their money around, and everybody signs on, and what we have is the modern Federal Reserve is nothing other than the foreign bankers' conspiracy against the United States. How many of you think that? I'm not surprised, but you're wrong. You've got one leg of the elephant. Okay? Now you got to think. We just elected a semi-populist president of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, the first candidate of the Democratic Party in 12 years at that point, 16 years, who was named William Jennings Bryan. And Bryan's faction controlled Congress, the House anyway. So you think that they're just going to roll over and play dead when they say, well, here comes that foreign banker's bill, you better vote for it. No. They had their own view. What did they want? They wanted an agricultural credit system to be created by the federal government. They kind of wanted the old populist party of 1892 platform. They wanted the right to deposit grain in warehouses inspected by the government, get a receipt, and then have the right to walk into the local national bank, present that receipt, and say, you must give me local money, national currency, of, say, 85% of the market value of this receipt. That's what the buy-in faction wanted. And they wanted it so much, they would sign on for just about anything that provided an agricultural lending facility. Then there was sort of what we'll call the 1913 version of the Shadow Committee on Banking Regulation. My buddies in the academic world faced it. And they said, let us study this issue intellectually and let us propose reforms to the money and banking system. Who was the leader of that faction? They're in his home state. Senator Carter Glass of Virginia, then a representative, and he's chairman, not as somebody who was chairman, but he was the most important member on the House Banking Committee at the time. Carter Glass had an academic expert named Parker Willis at Columbia University who helped him draft the plan, the Glass Reform Bill. My view is the final Federal Reserve Act of 1913 has more lines of text in it, more substantive provisions in it from the Glass version of the bill than any of the competing factions. So here's another of those legs of the elephant. Pure reform. What did Glass want? Well, he wanted the money power broken up and spread out to New York City. He didn't want it concentrated in the capital's demand. He didn't trust New York bankers anymore then than he possibly should today. So we wanted a system of regional reserve banks created, eventually 12 were created. He did not want a federally appointed board of governors in Washington running the system. Turned out that in the final compromises, Woodrow Wilson wanted that. That's the next leg of the ultimate, by the way, is what we'll call the traditional how do you get them out of the Beltway mentality folks. Those who say, we here in Washington know better than anywhere else how to run things. And if you'll just do it our way, either you'll be happy or we'll make certain we never hear any complaints. Well, that crowd around Wilson, embodiment of progressive era idealism, misguided though it occasionally was. And as I'm sure everyone else in the room here would argue, they certainly were on the income tax. That same mindset said, well, we can't have this agricultural lending institution, this emergency lending of 1907 panic, Aldrich Freeland Act type institution. We can't have this foreign banker representative institution. We can't have that thing without a strong guiding hand of the federal government in Washington, directly accountable. Congress, executive, judiciary, which the Constitution says it has to be Congress. So how do you get a central bank appointed by the president that kind of plays ball with the administration always and is always going to be loyal to the administration's way of doing things? How can you do that constitutionally? To create an interpretation, of course. So, by the 1920s, the doctrine had arrived at the Supreme Court, on the deal of all challenges to the Federal Reserve Act, that Congress may delegate one of its constitutional powers to the executive for either a defined term of years, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, subject to annual review and reporting to Congress, and subject to the appropriations process for its dark variety operations. Well, so the structure of the Federal Reserve passes that kind of a constitutional test. Anyway, you've got the rough picture now of the legs of the elephant. But to make it work, you need a man whose mind was, shall we say, unburdened by particular commitments to any particular principle. You need a man open to compromise. A man willing to take credit for being the intellectual author of this thing, even though there is not a shred of evidence that he ever wrote a single word to get it through. Senator Robert Owen of Oklahoma. And that's how I got through the Senate. The Federal Reserve Board likes Owen. They have his statue outside the building. The Federal Reserve Banks don't think much of Owen except in New York, where they generally like the idea of centralized power. It's just their hope that they can sort of have it and use it without the other banks figuring it out. There used to be a picture of Carter Glass, the reformer, hung in a place of honor down on the main floor of the Federal Reserve Building. Next time any of you visit the building on a tour, my challenge to you is find the Carter Glass portrait, or ask the guys if you know where it was. Ask the guys if they can even tell you who he was. Last time I saw it, the glass portrait was upstairs in a corner of a woman's private dining room. This movement of Glass's portrait has occurred within the last 15 years or so. One of the problems, institutionally at best, the lowest problem, is that the old guys may remember the debates of the founding, the earlier sharp and pointed debates, and new guys do things their way. It's a certain amount of convenience of getting, a certain amount of passing on. That's kind of what's happened at the Fed. If the old guys aren't around to remind you anymore of what you're supposed to stand for, then it becomes very easy to do something else. So that's it in a nutshell about how we got to the modern world. The 1933 detour. Now, this thing I was describing to you in 1913, it was mostly glass, or I'll call it glass primarily, but with these other screens feeding into it. Okay? And it wasn't too bad an institution as originally framed. For one thing, did the Federal Reserve originally have legal tender money issuing power? The answer is no. They had lawful money status only for Federal Reserve notes. There were four competing currency systems down to 1933. Federal Reserve notes, national bank notes, the ones that I described earlier, U.S. notes, notes issued by the Treasury itself, and gold and silver coin were circulating. What year did all of that stop? 1933. Under the powers of the Emergency Banking Act, which was rested in turn on the Trading of the Enemy Act of 1917, President Roosevelt essentially suspended private transactions in gold, suspended the redeemability of U.S. notes in gold or silver. You could still get silver for a while after, but that ended in the 1960s. The gold coin was withdrawn from circulation. Only Federal Reserve notes were left out there standing. And in a resolution, resolution adopted by Congress in June of 33 confirming this outcome. Congress did pass a resolution saying, yes, it is our intention that Federal Reserve notes shall be legal tender, which is a higher and stricter legal standard than lawful money. And that meant from that day forward, what you think of as unbacked Federal Reserve notes, irredeemable Federal Reserve notes, has been a legal tender ever since. As framed in 1913, so I was asking Beth to do this process at the end of my remarks and take some questions now. As framed in 1913, was the Fed conceived of as part and parcel of some monstrous progressive U.S. scheme allied to the income tax as a necessary component for oppressing the American people? The answer is no. In fact, at the time, the Fed was explicitly prohibited, thanks to Blatt and the Reform Faction, the Fed was explicitly prohibited from using U.S. government obligations as backing for its currency notes. The Fed was supposed to use either gold and silver, or foreign exchange, or private obligations that it acquired in the open market as the backing for Federal Reserve notes. But that all changed in 33. After 33, the Fed was allowed to issue currency in exchange for treasury obligations that it held. Two parties have to collude for that expansion of the unbacked monetary system to work. The treasury has to issue bonds or other paper that the Fed then purchases. It's a two-party game. The Fed can't run it alone. Neither can the Treasury as long as there is a central bank. Both need the other. Each needs the other. And that's how the game works today. If the Fed wanted to expand the money supply, it has to buy more Treasury obligations. Because it has to issue more obligations if the Fed is going to have them supply. If surplus, nominal surplus continues, this is an interstate puzzle for the Fed. They don't quite know what to buy if the treasury obligations go away. The answer is, maybe the rethink Carter Glass's original formula and buy some private obligations again. Gold, silver, foreign exchange, and private obligations. It's not a bad backing for currency. So, in a nutshell, that's kind of how we got to where we are today. I hope I've dispelled some of the myths about how the Fed was created, why it was created, what the constitutional basis for the Fed is. Working on that point, is the modern Federal Reserve constitutional, especially if it has a private ownership component at the Reserve Bank? Answer is, even if you think it's not, you have to overturn McCulloch versus Merrill to get to where you want to go. Because John Marshall explicitly ruled that the institutional structure of the Second Bank of the United States was constitutional. The president appointed five of the 25 directors, private interests elected the other 20 shareholders of the bank, and the shareholders were private sector entities. If that system is constitutional, so is the Fed. Okay? So don't come to me complaining that Congress ought to throw out the Fed as unconstitutional tomorrow morning unless you're willing to refight the McCulloch versus Maryland itself and say it was wrongly decided. And if you're not there, and you'll get massive resistance, especially this time to that, because McCulloch is, due to its doctrine of implied power within the Constitution, it is the bedrock of modern-day government. So getting McCulloch overturned is like saying, let's abolish modern-day government. Maybe that's what we want to do. You are somewhat tilting at windmills as long as you say, oh, let me leave McCulloch alone, but let's just get rid of the Fed. to need some backing for my view of the original 1913 Act access resources, especially on the harbor glass, as a former view. I recommend highly, especially the governor's, his biography called Harbor Glass, a biography by his longtime secretary, Christy Smith, R-I-S-T-Y, Christy Smith, and Norma Beasley, who were authors who published in 1939, 2 years before last died. A parallel thing you can look at is the 1920s writings of H. Parker Willis, that's Y-L-L-I-S, Columbia University, who was the principal draftsman for glass, what was called glass sections of the original 1913 Act. He wrote a couple of books, opinions of his own writers and others, amounting to the code system, what it was intended for, how it is actually being used. There's a good, for lawyers in the audience, there is a good old guess that the Federal Reserve used to publish here in Washington. I don't know if they still do. It was called Lending Functions of the Federal Reserve Bank, a History by Howard Hackley, H-A-C-K-L-E-Y. The last version of it was from 78 or so. But that's the history of the discount lender instead. And he traced the fact that his origins as the banking response to that 1907 panic and the desire to create currency backed by private credit obligations. So that's it. I'll take the
question. That's it for tonight, folks. Now, remember, listen to everyone, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you can prove it in your own research. Just because he said it tonight, don't take for granted that it's true. Walker Todd worked for most of his life for the Federal Reserve Bank. Where do you think his loyalty lies? That'll give you just one clue as to why you should question some of the things that he says. I have no doubt that most of what he said is probably true. But there are some things that you'll find out tomorrow night when we get into the question and answer period, and he's sort of pinned to the wall by some pretty knowledgeable people in the audience. By the way, this whole thing took place February the 17th, 2001, this year, just last month, February the 17th in Virginia. Good night, folks. God bless each and every single one of you. Good night, Annie Pooh and Allison. I love you. Evan. Evan's our buddy in Hollywood that did all this music for us, folks. What a talent. You know what this represents? They just gave it to us for the exclusive use of the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper, the most dangerous radio host in America. From now until April 15th, we'll be exposing the criminal, unconstitutional, despotic Internal Revenue Service, the money system, how all this came about, what it means to you. Don't miss one single night. All oldies, most of the time.
You cheated, you lied.